Sunset Lake CBD is a majority employee-owned hemp farm located right outside of Burlington, Vermont. Before they started growing hemp, Sunset Lake Farms produced cream for Ben & Jerry's. Sunset Lake CBD doesn't use any pesticides or herbicides to grow any of its hemp plants, and they use organic fertilizer and other sustainable farming techniques to ensure the long-term health of the soil and to minimize their carbon footprint. So like all of us, my days are really stressful. By the end of the night, my kids are in bed, I'm taking a minute to chill, but I'm still unwinding. I recently started using the Relax Gummies infused with CBD isolate, reishi mushroom extract, and ashwagandha root extract. I'm really glad I tried these because they really helped me get ready for a good night of sleep, and I really think I sleep better, so I'd highly recommend it. So check out Sunset Lake CBD today at sunsetlakecbd.com and use the code HFPOD for 20% off your order. That's sunsetlakecbd.com and use the code HFPOD for 20% off your order. Farmer owned, Vermont grown, Sunset Lake CBD.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey listeners, I want to tell you about a sponsor, Music Masters Collective. They're a nonprofit organization that produces unique music events, providing opportunities for fans and artists to meet and collaborate in an inspired and creative atmosphere. Every week, they host different events, all with the opportunity to learn from world-class musicians like Oteil Burbridge, Trouble No More, former members of The Band, Milk Carton Kids, Nikki Glaspie, Bill Frisell, Sean Colvin, and many more. This June, join the Fab Faux, Joan Osborne, John Sebastian, Marshall Crenshaw, and a great group of faculty for the debut of Magical Mystery Camp. This all-inclusive, once-in-a-lifetime music vacation experience in the heart of the Catskills will be packed with nightly performances, workshops, speakers, song circles, open mics, and a lot more. If you're a performing musician at any level, bring your instrument. If you're a music lover, bring your good spirit. It's an amazing experience for individuals, friends, and couples alike. Registration is open, spots are filling up, so check it out soon, and scholarships are available. Check out magicalmysterycamp.com/helpingfriendly to learn more.
Hey everyone, this is the Helping Friendly Podcast. This is episode 93, and we are excited to be joined by Jefferson Waffle, who many of you I'm sure know. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I'm a big fan of your show.
Awesome. We appreciate you saying that. And
that's very kind.
You of course are the lighting director for Umphrey's McGee, and you're a creative content producer for CID. You're a journalist. We want to get into sort of all aspects of that. Before we get into that, though, we should say you are at Jefferson Waffle, W-A-F-U-L, on Twitter, if people don't already follow you. And Jonathan, before we get into the conversation, what's going on in the fish world this week?
Well, let's see. Mike's on tour. That started up last weekend, so hopefully people are catching that out there in and around Thanksgiving and whatnot. And then Trey was on Prairie Home Companion. I hope everybody had a chance to hear that. Did you check it out, RJ? I think you mentioned
some of it. Yeah, it was pretty cool. He played a couple songs you don't hear very often, so that was pretty cool.
Yeah, it's nice to hear a full bluegrass arrangement for Water in the Sky and Brian and Robert even. It's really cool. So anybody out there, if you haven't heard it, go seek it out. It's definitely out there on the prairiehome.org or something, or elsewhere on the internet probably too.
Yeah, and we'll put a link to that in the show notes. Jefferson, did you catch that?
You know, I caught I think there was one pro shot video that I saw, and it was the Get Back on the Train, and I watched the first 5 seconds and immediately had to email it to my dad because that's right in his wheelhouse. He plays that song out like with his bluegrass buddies on the weekends.
No way.
Nice.
they're all huge, like, Chris Thiele fans. And so, like, I sent it to him immediately, and it was great. I love the harmonies on there. I hope they collaborate more or do a tour or something.
Yeah, Chris Thiele is terrific. I've been listening to him since he was very young, and I was quite young then, too. But he's terrific, and I it's the first chance I had to listen to Prairie Home since he has taken over the show, and I like that direction. So
yeah,
cool choice.
Yeah, it's really cool. It's a good modern, I guess, modern replacement for the recently retired Garrison Keillor, right?
Yeah, it's good to go another direction.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
And another example for Trey to wear one of those blazers, which he loves. So yeah, I thought he's in fine form.
Very true. So Jefferson, let's talk a little bit about your background. I mean, of course, the work with Umphreys is super interesting. I think people would be interested to hear just sort of your path, how you got from, you know, probably an interest in music, I guess, starting off to where you are now, and we'll get into some more depth along the way. But what's your sort of perspective on how you got to where you are today?
Well, I've always been a very visual person, and always, you know, I've been playing guitar since I was, you know, 2 years old or something, just because my dad always had guitars around. And, you know, that the old cliche about, you know, jack of all trades, master of none, I think that really applies to me. I kind of treat my adult life the same way I treated my childhood, which is I just go from playing with the Legos to then go, you know, playing with the cassette deck to playing with my keyboard. I just kind of jump from one fun project to the next. And it took me, so I was probably in college, to kind of find the common thread between all of the things that I do. And I think they all kind of fall under the category of, you know, entertainer at some, you know, mm-hmm. whether it's as a writer or as, you know, a lighting designer or, you know, whatever other, you know, video editor.
Cool.
So I went from journalism. First I did video editing in high school. Then I did journalism, which is, you know, related broadcast journalism. And then did a radio show in college, which is where I really started to meet a lot of the music industry people that I'm still friends with today. Because as you guys know, the jam world is so small, and there's so many, you know, so many of the same people that are still involved today that they were in, you know, 1995 or whatever, when I started doing college radio in Boston. And then I managed a band, and that's where I started doing lights, just because I thought it was another fun toy.
Nice.
And we didn't have anyone else to do it. And that led to some freelance work, and that led to a tryout with Mo in 2004. And then
cool.
From Mo, about 5 years later, they took a hiatus, and then I got a tryout with Umphreys.
Wow.
And there was, you know, a bunch of journalism gigs in there as well. Because the thing about touring is you have a lot of time off in between tours, and you have to kind of find other jobs to supplement. And now it's CID Entertainment, but back then it was Relics and jambands.com. So right, I hope that's a short enough answer.
That's
no,
great.
That's pretty good.
Well, it sounds like we were talking about the bluegrass stuff before that question. It sounds like you come from a musical family, and did you kind of always have your mind on music necessarily, or was it just something that you did in terms of, you know, what you wanted to be when you grew up or whatever? Was it just like you described, sort of just having fun and doing whatever was fun?
I think it was more just for fun. I don't think I ever had aspirations to be a professional musician. I think I spent hundreds of hours in my bedroom, you know, multi-tracking songs, but a lot of times I was just recreating other people's songs. You know, I, as far back as like, you know, 10 years old, I did my own version of Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, and I multi-tracked every part on a Casio.
Nice.
And
nice.
I think I could actually hit the harmonies, you know, pre-pubescent Jefferson. but I think I, you know, my fantasy in those days was to be the center fielder for the Boston Red Sox. So I...
That's a solid dream.
Right.
Yeah.
I think I had a much better chance of being a musician now that I look back on it. But I think it was one of those instances where it's like you... not take it for granted, but you just kind of assume everyone plays guitar with their dad in their living room. And, you know, now at this point in my life, most of my friends did, because those are the people that we've chosen to surround ourselves with. I don't think it's right. Very uncommon, but in the world at large, it may be a smaller percentage of people that grew up jamming with their dad around a campfire or whatever. But yeah, never was an aspiration. I think maybe that's why I never was that good. I mean, I'm an okay rhythm guitarist, but I just never saw it as a profession for me. It's more just like pick up the guitar and strum along.
Well, that's, you know, really music doesn't have to playing music doesn't have to give you anything financially, if as long as it gives you something, some internal satisfaction. So,
right. It's really, it's a great point, because I find myself playing guitar less and less now, because I've surrounded myself with the best musicians and the best production people in the world. And I feel like, well, I can't compete with that, so why bother? Which is a horrible philosophy. I don't recommend it, by the way, because what you said is totally true. Like, I should just be able to sit in my living room and play guitar for the joy of it. But when I pick up a guitar, I say, well, it doesn't sound as good as X, Y, and Z. Mm-hmm. You know, Chris Thiele can play, you know, better scales than me, or, you know, Umphrey's McGee, those guys are all just robotic and, you know, just crazy musicians. So it's like, that's kind of where I'm at in my life now, for better or worse.
Right on. Well, you know, sounds like pretty good company to keep, at least.
Sure.
Sure. And Jefferson, there's...
That's actually why I went into lighting, because some of my friends that we had a band in college, and they all went to Berklee School of Music, and that's when I realized, I think my efforts could be better at management and lighting, and let them kind of handle the music.
Yeah, those Berklee kids, man, they tend to have some chops.
Right.
Well, it's interesting. I was just going to ask. I mean, I think for me, at least, thinking about, you know, if someone was like, can you do lights for a band? I would find that incredibly intimidating. Was it something that sort of came naturally to you, and something that you felt like you could sort of jump right into?
Yeah, it really was, because, I mean, the one thing that I will say, and I like to be self-deprecating or whatever, but like, I've always had good rhythm, because that's something that I feel like if you develop it from an early age, it stays with you. You know, it's like learning a language, a second language, as a young child. So, you know, because I was always playing I had drums before I ever even played guitar. And I, again, never was a great drummer, but I had that, you know, the DNA was in me where I can find the one very easily. It's innate. So the first few times I did lights, I was just tapping along with my fingers and, you know, hitting red and blue on the downbeat. And as the years went on, I kind of learned the technology as I went, and I kind of learned about, you know, odd time signatures, which helped by going to college with a bunch of music theory guys. But I was never really intimidated by it. The only thing I'm really intimidated by is when, you know, Umphrey's plays a song that they, you know, haven't played in 8 years or something, that they all know and I don't know.
Right. Well, that's part of the adventure, though, right?
Sure, of course.
I wasn't aware that you worked with Mo. And how long did you say you worked with them?
It was about 5 years. That was really my first big break. And, you know, I give them all the credit in the world for taking a chance on me, because I had no touring experience. And I guess that was probably the time that I was intimidated. And I wasn't intimidated to actually run lights. It was more intimidating just learning the culture and the touring, you know, philosophy, but, you know, just the, it was a
foreign
language. Yeah. It's a way of life, but there's also certain things that you have to, like, procedures you have to follow. And just, I never took a crash course in theater or in production. And so I think that was the hardest thing for me, was adapting to the road life and the touring etiquette.
Right on. Well, you know, I think I probably saw Mo during your tenure, actually, I have to think about it, but that's pretty cool. So I assume you enjoyed that, and then they took their break and you moved on to Umphrey's. Would you say that you found different challenges moving from one band to the other?
Yeah, you know, I learned very quickly that the way I interpret certain types of music needed to change really quickly, because just stylistically, Mo and Umphrey's, from an outsider, may seem very similar, but when you get into the, you know, the nuts and bolts of it, they're very different in the way that they construct their set lists. And just, for example, sure. Chuck Garvey, or Al, but I always think of Chuck for some reason, because I feel like a lot of the bigger songs, you know, the set closers, he's moving his fingers very, you know, 16th note arpeggios. And subconsciously, when I hear that, or even consciously, but mostly subconsciously, I go to my strobing big Ballyhoo look. And if I do that two or three times a show, he probably is going to do it two or three times a show. And it's subtle enough, and it's, you know, it's a good balance. Now Umphrey's, on the other hand, they might be a little bit more prog rocky, and certain shows might have 5 to 6 songs in a set where they're moving their fingers as fast as they can, lightning speed or whatever. And it, you know, it varies from night to night, depending on who writes the set list and what the,
sure,
the energy of the mood is. But I realized really quickly that if I strobed every time that they did that, that I would just be strobing the whole night. So I had to come up with new ways of interpreting, you know, very high energy music. And one of the things that I quickly learned was just to do the opposite and move extremely slowly and kind of do like a very slow emotive sweep when they're going really fast. So that was
nice.
That was a difference that I noticed right off the bat.
I like it when that happens. It's a good counter to high intensity music. It's just kind of lay out and let the music be the intense part.
Right.
And then,
and sometimes it's more, for me, it's more intense. Like I'll actually get, you know, I'll get the chills or, you know, from watching, you know, the band has so much energy pouring off the stage and everything's kind of moving in slow motion. It's like a climactic scene in a movie.
That's pretty sweet. And Jefferson, what's the most difficult part about doing that? I guess either the lighting itself or just the, you know, the life of being on the road. I mean, you know, I think people would love to hear about all those things, but what's the hardest part of doing the lights night to night?
Well, you know, I was thinking about this earlier and none of the things that are challenging really have to do with lights specifically. It's really all the things around them. I mean, the one thing that relates specifically to the lights is if I get distracted and that, you know, I've never really been able to determine, you know, what percentage of that is me being easily distracted and what percentage of that is like my surroundings, because there's certain venues where I'm totally cordoned off from any contact with anyone and I can just focus on the music and I can really just get sucked in and that's really easy. And then there's other venues where you're in like a theater where you're like right on the aisle and there's just people streaming by all night. And the odds of, you know, 1,000 people walking by you in 3 hours, odds are like a few of them are going to tap you on the shoulder and say, hey, it looks great, man. Or like, hey, can you turn the bass up? Or, you know, very well-intentioned people. They're just excited and they see someone and they want to high five you. And that'll throw me off because I might be counting in an odd time signature. And, you know, it diverts my attention momentarily. And I've never really been able to determine like if that's on me, if that's just because I should be able to block that out or if it's simply the act of turning my head to acknowledge someone and now I'm kind of lost where I was in the music.
Sounds like a human problem. I mean, theoretically, none of us can actually multitask. So it kind of makes sense to me.
Thinking about it like, go ahead.
I was just going to say it would be really hard for me to go to work and like, do writing or whatever I'm doing and like having people come and tap you on the shoulder every like minute or two. Right.
Yeah. Right. I mean, I was thinking of an analogy earlier. It was like, if you're, and anyone who's a musician has done this, you know, like you're in high school or whatever, and you're learning a new solo and you're really getting it and you're like making progress and you just keep playing the solo over and over and over again. And you're trying to get it perfect. And I used to do this, maybe it's just me, but like you try to play it through perfectly all the way without messing up once. And you're 3/4 of the way through the song and your mom knocks on the door and she's like, sweetie, dinner's ready. And you're like, oh, mom, you screwed me up. Like I was so close.
Right.
It's kind of like that, except it's a stranger and you have to try to be polite in the moment and try to immediately acknowledge them in a polite way and say, thank you, or, you know, whatever. And then go back to the music and not have it be like a kind of a mental block. And again, it varies so much from venue to venue. A lot of larger venues, you're totally cordoned off and you have like a moat of, you know, 10 feet on all sides of you in a large front of house area, like in an arena, for example.
Right.
But to get back, I kind of got off on a tangent. The other challenges are just like the schedule being away for so long. It makes it hard on any kind of relationship. I don't have a family yet, but a lot of the other guys have kids now and wives and that's a challenge. So, you know, Umphrey's has actually tailored the way that they tour in the last couple of years when everyone in the band started having children, where we don't go away now for 3 weeks at a time. We go away for, you know, I think 4 shows is the most we'll do. And then, you know, kind of like the weekend warrior thing. And then everyone will have the option to go home for 3 or 4 days and then go back and do another 3 or 4 shows.
That's good.
So I feel really lucky that they've kind of done that. But in years past, you know, you'd be gone for 3.5 weeks and that's a challenge. And, you know, just living on a bus with a bunch of people, it's like, you know, marriages are tough enough when it's 2 people. But when you have, we used to be 12 people on a bus it's a lot of fun. There's a lot, you know, all the things you see in the movies and you assume happen, like those things all happen.
Yeah.
Maybe not as many girls, but all the other stuff. And, but there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of really challenging things, you know, like five guys brushing their teeth at the same time while you're drinking your coffee in the morning, like just little things that you don't think about. You're all in such a small space, and it takes a really long time to kind of adapt and learn about yourself, what you need, and, you know, how to kind of just keep your head down and stay out of people's way is a challenge.
Yeah, that's interesting. And that's like it's kind of like survival mode, right? You do what you need to get by and have fun, and but also, like you said, learn how to kind of do your own thing and get done what you need to get done.
Yeah, it's just so monotonous over time. You go to these same music venues, and I remember being a kid looking at the backstage from the audience and thinking, like, wow, what is back there? You know, that's like the promised land. That's, if I could ever get back there, it would be amazing. And then 30 years later, you're back there, and it's a concrete room with some chairs and some concrete hallways. And, you know, you've been doing it for so long that you just need to get out of there. And I remember, like, when I first started touring, you'd go to, you know, a big festival like Bonnaroo or something, and the really big headlining acts, they'd get off stage and they'd immediately, their bus would be on the highway. You know, they'd get a police escort out. And, you know, some of the older bands, they just immediately leave the venue as soon as they walk off stage. And mm-hmm. I can never understand that. I always be like, well, don't they want to hang out and, like, see everyone and party and, like, see their friends? And I totally get it now. You know, you do it enough times, and all you want to do is just get away. That doesn't mean that you're not going to enjoy the show and enjoy the experience, but it's like there needs to be some balance with real life and, you know, being in an environment that's not concrete walls and, or, you know, even being on the tour bus. A lot of bands now, they just, the larger acts just go right to a hotel because everyone needs to kind of like have their own space. Mm-hmm. And that's interesting to me.
Well, you know, so, it is a job, and over 20 years as a band or whatever, you know, being on the bus definitely has to get old. So you got to do things a little differently in order to keep the train rolling, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, I am very, very fortunate because Umphrey's has gone now from the, you know, 12 of us on the bus to now we have two buses. So there's a band bus and a crew bus. And, you know, our team does such an amazing job at making sure that we're never really, with the exception of like some crazy routing to hit a couple festivals in the same weekend or something, for the most part, we're never on the bus during the day. So it's like, you know, we sleep and then we wake up, we're there, and then we get on the bus, we sleep. So you can actually just be asleep the whole time. I mean, we stay up and unwind after the show and, you know, socialize for a couple hours at night, but, you know, usually you wake up and you're at your next stop. So that makes it a lot easier.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's great.
Nice. Well, Jefferson, I think a lot of people who listen to this we're obviously, you know, fish related podcast, but a lot of people think about lights and think about the, you know, how much awesome value you and Chris Kuroda and others add to people's experiences. When you mentioned sort of improvising a little bit there, how much of what we see is when the band is improvising, are you improvising versus scripted? Could you point to a percentage, or is it just more totally depend on the night and the feel?
I would say 99.9% improvisation on my part.
Wow.
Just the only times that I don't improvise are if the band is covering a song that has a lighting designer that is a really big part of the show. Like if they cover Radiohead, I'm going to do lights very similar to the way that the Radiohead guy does it, because I feel like it's an important part of the song. Or Nine Inch Nails or Pink Floyd. But even then, I'm kind of improvising because I'm not doing the exact same thing each time. I'm emoting the same kind of style.
Mm-hmm.
But the same way that, you know, our band is not playing to a click track most of the time. So like the tempo is going to be a little bit different, and they may be feeling a little bit more playful on a certain night. So mm-hmm. they might improvise certain sections of the song, you know, prior to the actual open sections, which a lot of the songs have. So I find that that's a lot more interesting and keeps me engaged and keeps me, you know, inspired, that it's not the same every night.
So can I ask you, you kind of led me to this by mentioning, you know, Radiohead, and, you know, they have a great production of shows, and, I would guess, that coming up as a Fish fan as well, Chris Kuroda is an obvious influence on your lighting. Anybody else that you might name? Did you see Grateful Dead? Like, see Candace Brightman? And would you say,
you know, I was about 3 or 4 years too young to see a lot of Grateful Dead shows. Just, you know, I graduated high school in 1993.
Okay.
And I was just didn't really even get turned on to fish until I got out of high school because there was no internet, or none that I knew about anyway. And
right.
I saw two Grateful Dead shows, and one of them was Highgate. So I remember it being mostly light out, but I'm sure there was like a second set that I don't remember that was dark. But and I saw one show at the Boston Garden. But yeah. I don't remember. A lot of my influences rave about Candace. And so I respect her work, and I know that she's, you know, she was one of Chris Carota's biggest influences and a lot of other LDs that I know. But I personally just unfortunately was not able to see a lot of her work. Mark Brickman from Pink Floyd okay. is a big influence. I only saw one Pink Floyd show in 94.
I saw that tour.
Yeah. And that, I don't even think was that. Oh, it was amazing. I had like the worst seat in the house way off to the side. So I don't even think I was very influenced by that night specifically, but that Pulse DVD that everyone that I know, you know, has studied, that was a huge influence. I mean, I probably watched that hundreds and hundreds of times. And so Mark Brickman, and, you know, one of the things that I always talk about that is kind of funny, two non-musical influences that were huge in my upbringing were, you know, growing up on Cape Cod, I watched the sunset so many times, and the gradient colors that you get, you know, watching the sun over the water, just, you know, unmatched and different every time.
Nice.
And, you know, when I was really young and impressionable, my mom would take me to quilt shows, and the symmetry and the geometric patterns from these quilts is, you know, I didn't even discover that until a couple years ago. And I was looking at some of her old quilts and just realizing like, oh, I bet that was like some subconscious thing that happened when I was 3 years old and, you know, impressionable and looking at the world. That had to have had some impact, because now when I look at the light show that I do, it's very similar in the way that the colors and the patterns and the geometry all kind of blend together.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
That's really cool.
I certainly wouldn't have guessed that, but I can see it. It makes sense.
Yeah, and as you said, obviously Chris Carota is the biggest influence. It would be impossible to go to. I stopped really keeping track, but somewhere probably around 250 fish shows, and the majority of them when I was, you know, in my 20s, it would be impossible to go to that many shows and not have that be your biggest influence, you know, the yeah, same way that right. when I've talked to him, he always talks about how when he started off, you know, Candace was his biggest influence or nice. One of them. So
yeah, I've definitely seen him mention that in interviews. That's why I led with that question.
Yeah.
So let's talk about fish and fish shows for a minute, if we could.
Sure.
So 250-ish. When was your first?
I believe it was the Greatwood show in 93, which I believe was, and I always screw this up, it was either July 21st or July 24th. But yeah, there was only one at Greatwoods, and I thought I was going to see Fishbone because I didn't know anything about anything at the time.
Very different show.
Right, and one of my buddies just said, hey, do you want to go see Fishbone? I'm like, okay, cool. And I got there, and my life was literally changed forever. Like my entire career path, like totally skewed off. Like, you know, if you went back to the future, you went back to 1993, that's when everything changed. So
that's awesome. 7/24/93.
Thank you. Thank you.
And what, just to kind of keep going down that path, when did you see your most shows? Was it in the 93 to 97 or through to the breaks or?
You know, I wish it was. Those are my favorite years that you just said there, 93 to 97. Mm-hmm. But I think just, again, because of age and because of, like, the amount of expendable income I had and, you know, the amount of time off I could take from jobs, I think I wound up seeing more shows probably, like, in the late 90s, like, mm-hmm. 98 through 2000,
okay.
just because of the stage of life that I was at.
Yeah, makes sense.
But these are just off the top of my head. I haven't, you know, logged on to Fantasy Tour and done the stats or anything.
Right on.
Well, you can do that all on fish.net now. I'm just gonna.
Oh, okay. I did this in an app once, and forgive me if I'm remembering or forgetting which one it was. It may have been your app. I did it a couple years ago, and I was around 200, which was way lower than I thought it would be. And I don't remember all the shows. I just kind of threw in anything in the Northeast, and that time I assume I was there.
Nice.
But I was around 200 or so.
Awesome. There was an app called the Helping Friendly app.
I think that's what it was.
Yeah, which does not have to do with us, but it's we should have Maybe we should have thought about that when we were doing our sort of landscape analysis of branding, but but we didn't. But that's what it did, right? It was to help search data, like you can search the database. I guess it still exists. I've actually never used it. Jefferson, when you think about just those years of Phish, when you were seeing them, that's after you had already gotten into working for a band and doing the lights. What were your, just back to the Kuroda question, what does he do, I guess, that's different, better? What are the keys that like make him, you know, such an icon in the lighting world?
Well, one slight correction. I wasn't doing lights when I saw most of my early Phish. Like I didn't start doing lights professionally until, you know, probably the early 2000s.
Oh, okay, got it.
So, and I don't know if this is a coincidence or not, but it made it more magical to me before I worked in that line of work, if that makes sense. You know what I mean? Like once I became a professional touring LD, I kind of was looking at it more as work. Not like I didn't enjoy it, but, oh, yeah, I know how he does that. And, oh, I know how he does that. When I was a kid, when I was, you know, 25, everything just blew my mind. I had no idea. It was all magic. I had no idea what was going on. I walked out of every show saying that was the best show I've ever seen every night. And my friends used to give me shit. They're like, dude, that's not possible. You can't see the best show every night.
Well, I don't know. Again, you know, when I started seeing Phish, it was just about the best show. Every show was better than the last.
That's what I think.
And I think I started seeing him right around when you did. I saw him, started seeing him at 94, and it was just bang, bang, bang. Good
right,
show.
And that's that whole like age old question of like nature versus nurture. Like, was it my perspective because I was young and impressionable, or am I now old and jaded, or are they playing differently now? It's just like it's hard to know where that line is. To get back to your question about Kuroda, I think the biggest thing that I was influenced by him was those slow, graceful movements. Because when the moving light was, you know, first taken out on the road, I mean, it's you know, I'm not a historian, but from what I understand, when they first designed it, it was designed theatrically to light up a subject matter on a spot on the stage, the way you would with a traditional Parkin or a Leco. And then you would shut the light off and the subject would move and hit another spot and you could move the light without having a second light there. And you could come up with multiple spots on the stage. Like if you think about a Broadway show, if the guy has 17 spots, now instead of having 17 different lights or however many lights you have per spot on the stage, you could just have the lights move. And over time, people, you know, Candace talks about this. They kind of by accident left the light on one time while it was moving. And it was this kind of aha moment. It was actually, I think, during Terrapin Station, the story that I heard from her and her team. One night, for whatever reason, they left the fader up by accident and the lights were moving to a higher position and it wound up being this incredible thing. And, you know, I don't know, lots of other people may have had that realization as well. Mark Brickman also does a lot with, you know, the slow moving lights. But that was the thing that probably influenced me the most with Chris. I remember a song like Reba, for example. You know, he'll go to like in the quiet section, he'll go to like a 15 or a 20 second movement and the lights kind of move so slowly that you almost can't perceive it unless you're looking for it.
Right.
And I think that's great. And again, Phish is known for their, you know, really high energy jamming, but the subtlety and the nuance was what I was really drawn to, I think.
That's pretty cool. You've also taken on this role working for CID, with creative content producer. Can you tell us a little bit about what you're doing with them?
Sure. I mean, again, that goes back to the kind of, you know, jack of all trades, master of none. I've worked with them, their founder, Dan Berkowitz, and I've been friends for a lot of years. And, you know, he comes from kind of a jam band background. He was tour managing the Disco Biscuits. Right. His wife used to work for Jam Bass. So, I mean, we're all kind of in that circle that I was talking about where, like, you're friends with the same people in the jam band world for a lot of years because it's a really small circle. And we just started working together when we both lived in Brooklyn. And I helped him out with Phil Lesh and friends. They did a 14-night run at the Nokia Theater. And we just kind of hit it off. And so over the years, Dan would hire his friends that when he needed different positions filled. You know, it's kind of how I got into, similar to how I got into lighting. You know, when there's a need, you fill it with whoever is around. And then, right. You know, as the company grew, I kind of grew to wear many hats. And, you know, thankfully, they're, you know, they allow me to kind of tailor my schedule due to my touring schedule. So I'm very grateful for that.
Nice. So. And is the CID gig, is that how the Mexico stuff came together?
Yeah, they decided to launch CID Presents a couple years ago. And the first show they did was Luke Bryan's Crash My Playa, which is kind of a country thing.
Yep.
And I was hired to be the site lighting designer. And Dan had this idea that he wanted to light up the ocean because, you know, you go to a lot of these destination events and it looks beautiful during the day. And then as soon as the sun goes down, you basically can't tell you're at the beach. I mean, obviously you're standing in sand, but you can't see that beautiful panoramic view.
If there's a big blackness beside you.
Right.
Yeah.
So Dan, I still remember this email he sent me, you know, 3 years ago, and the subject line was lighting up the ocean. It's a really great email to get. You know, I don't know if I've ever gotten a cooler email than that. He just had this vision of like, let's put these huge towers. And, you know, if you envision, for those of you who weren't in Mexico last year for fish, if you almost like, you know, if you're at a baseball game, obviously smaller, but, you know, these big towers, we had four of them lining the beach, just shining out at the ocean. And we had no idea what it was going to look like until we did it. I mean, we guessed, but like, you know, most of the shows that I've done have been in either indoor venues or you're outdoors and you're hitting a lawn or you're hitting whatever the back of the venue is. But to just shoot these big, powerful lights out at nothingness, you don't know how far they're going to go. And what we wound up discovering was that blue light looks better than white light. When we shined white light on the ocean, it looked like someone was escaping from prison. And it was like a searchlight.
Nice. Yeah, yeah. Okay.
So we quickly learned like, well, if you hit it with blue light, it looks more like it's supposed to look. And that you can kind of create your own horizon. Wherever the lights stop winds up looking like the horizon, even if it's not.
Yeah,
which is awesome. A really cool effect. And it was a really cool learning experience for us because we planned it for a year. And again, until we got down there that first night and turned the lights on, we didn't really know what to expect.
Wow. That's no pressure, right?
Right.
And so then, excuse me, then you ended up doing that with fish, right?
Yeah. And that was totally kind of spontaneous. My role as site lighting designer the year before with the country festival, Crash My Playa, was to, you know, set the scene on the water and on the trees and just kind of make it look pretty. And then the show would be the main focus. But I knew going in, as soon as we confirmed fish, that would all be totally different because, you know, growing up as a fish fan, I know that fish likes to put their stamp in every little detail when they put on an event, which is what makes it so special.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So we were down there about a week early with our team and Chris's team and kind of talking about how things were going to go. And I kind of said, well, you know, we can just kind of set a look and leave it, or you can set the look, or, you know, whatever you want to do. And they were thinking about it. And I think he didn't have enough hands to kind of do everything the way he wanted. And I think the song that we talked about was 2001. Because he said, you know, maybe I'll just have you fade the lights up and down or something very subtle. And I said, okay. And I said, what about like 2001? Do you want me to just leave them static? And I could see the gears in his head kind of turning. And he said, well, we'll see, or, you know, we'll come back to it. And then kind of gradually over the course of the week, we came up with, you know, just two or three songs where we would do something very subtle and it would be totally his, you know, he was the director and he's calling and everything. And I'm basically just a set of hands.
Right.
And as the weekend progressed, you know, all the fans started jumping in the water, which nobody expected. And that was an amazing moment. So, you know, now everyone's looking out at them splashing. And I would, you know, because I'm used to hitting every change, I would sometimes switch colors on the downbeat. And Chris would sometimes give me a, you know, shake his head, like, chill out, like, don't change that quickly. And I'd say, okay, sorry. Or other times he would kind of give me a look like, yeah, go with it. It's cool. And it was all such a great learning experience for me.
Wow.
Because I'm used to being the mind making the decisions.
Yeah, yeah.
And so to kind of take a step back, you know, one of my friends described it as like, I'm used to playing lead guitar and I was playing rhythm guitar. And it, you know, it's one of the things that a lot of lighting designers talk about being the biggest challenge is knowing when to, you know, not do anything, like having that restraint. And so this was even more so. And, you know, there were definitely some times where I had to like put my hands behind my back and, you know, stop myself from being tempted to want to hit the change, because without even trying, I mean, we all know those songs from listening to them all our lives, which right. actually wound up being a little bit of a, you know, a negative for me, because it made me more tempted to try to, you know, change color on the downbeat and riff or whatever.
Interesting.
But yeah, it was definitely one of the highlights of my life. That's for sure.
It's pretty cool.
And are you engaged to cook up something for next year's event?
Yeah, I mean, we're like very close. Our, you know, we start planning probably at the beginning, you know, like in the spring sometime, and we're going down for another site visit on Monday.
Wow,
so
wow.
Cool. Plans are well underway.
That's awesome. It's interesting to play, like you were the analogy of playing guitar. Like, I'm sure, you know, Trey would, like in 98, the Farm Aid comes to mind when he was happy to play rhythm guitar for Neil Young, you know?
Right.
It's like, if one of your idols is doing it, you got to just, you know, step back and learn. That's pretty cool.
Right.
Well, you know, with playing, sometimes it's about what you don't play.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, remember, that's the same for you as we know about music probably, but maybe not about lighting.
Oh, absolutely. It's the same thing. I mean, I do it all the time. I have to step away from the board because, you know, your tendency is to try to, for me anyway, and I've spoken to other lighting designers who have the same philosophy. It's like you almost feel like you have to justify what you're doing there. You know, you have this big expensive lighting rig that costs like thousands and thousands of dollars, and you feel like you have to justify the cost at every second. And sometimes it's like, well, if it looks pretty, just leave it. You can leave a pretty look up for 30 seconds and nobody's gonna be upset if it looks pretty. And so that's a constant voice in my head saying like, you know what, chill out, put your hands down, this is a pretty moment, the band's not doing anything, like, there's no reason for the lights to be changing. And I think that's why the slow moving thing that I talked about, that, you know, I learned from watching Corrode all those years, that's one of the ways that I can, you know, not have any real big noticeable changes, but still have something visually happening that's subtle enough that it doesn't detract from what's happening on stage. And, you know, going back to Neil Young, I grew up listening to Neil Young, so I've always kind of followed his career, and, you know, it was always my dad's thing, and I was always into Fish. And so when they kind of intersected in 98, it was a really big deal. And I remember reading a quote from Trey where he said he saw Neil Young in Europe and he cried three times and it made him reevaluate what talent was. And I think that was such a great quote. And also right around the time where, you know, probably Billy Breathes was coming out, and, you know, you could really see that stylistically Fish growing up, you know, Trey had the baby and their, you know, the priorities started to shift. So, I mean, I always thought that was a really poignant quote and I always remember that.
Wow.
That's a great quote. That's very Trey.
Right.
Yeah, that's awesome. Jefferson, we want to we've taken a lot of your time and we want to leave everyone with a little bit of music, but I have one question I want to go back to regarding Umphrey's, because you've been part of the band and the culture for a long time now. How are they so good at engaging with fans and listening to fans? They seem to have done it naturally, but also it's really impressive how responsive they are, how engaged they are. Is it just come from a place of, you know, just wanting to be close to the fans? I'm just curious about your take on what they do.
Yeah, I mean, I think when I worked for Mo, they were like 5 to 10 years older than me, maybe more like 5 to 7 years older than me. And I remember when I started working for Umphrey's, they're all right about my age. So it really feels like we're all peers. So it's, I don't know, I just feel like they're at a place, and this has nothing to do with Mo, because Mo is very active on Twitter and they've been making videos lately. And I really, you know, have a lot of respect for those guys, but I bring it up because, I don't know, those guys all went to Notre Dame, a lot of them. And they all come from really intelligent backgrounds. Kevin Browning, who used to be our front of house engineer, became our, you know, he got off the road when he started having kids and he became our manager. And he is the, like the creative side. And so he spearheads a lot of those, you know, fan engagements. You know, that's really his, one of his strong points. So, mm-hmm. you know, we did a thing called the S2s, which was, you know, this like hour long VIP set where people could text. We still do it with Umble, the same idea. People can text in themes in real time and the band looks at the text on the screen and will immediately play it as the texts are coming in. And just, wild. I don't know, kind of pushing the envelope. They've always tried to be kind of on the cutting edge technologically.
That's cool.
We're trying anyway.
Yeah, and I guess that's just growing up with it and being more familiar with it is definitely part of it. That's just, it's so cool to see, and it's great to see, you know, the different kinds of engagements, including the musical kind of engagements. I've seen people with the headphones at shows, and I just think it's cool to kind of offer your fans different kinds of experiences to interact with the band in different ways. It's a pretty cool model that I hope other younger bands are learning from, you know?
Yeah, I think there was just, there were a lot of quote unquote rules growing up going to shows, you know, like, you know, no, bands never used to allow videotaping, for example, you know, with yeah. Fish in the early days, it was like, if they saw someone with a video camera, they immediately confiscate it. That was a major no-no. And, you know, the same thing with, like releasing every show on soundboard, because I think when there were record companies involved, they thought it would, you know, take away from their album sales. And I think with the internet, and I think this was the point I was trying to make a few minutes ago, talking about how we're all kind of the same age, but it's like, we're of the age where, you know, technology is really changing the business model for bands. And so we had to kind of be savvy. Luckily, and I don't know if anyone's ever used luckily in this context, but luckily we didn't sell a lot of albums. So when the economy crashed a few years ago and all these other bands were tanking, we never really made much money off album sales to begin with. So we kind of maintained, you know, and were able to survive at a time where the economy was bad. And, you know, people were scrambling to figure out how to make money in the music industry. And so to their credit, Kevin and management and the band, they kind of embraced the changing technology and, you know, offering, and I know lots of other bands do this too, but offering up the instant downloads, which Fish now does. And now that's actually become the norm, and, you know, allowing, you know, I guess iPhones have a lot to do with the whole video thing where it's impossible to police it at this point, but just releasing content on a regular basis and giving the fans what they want, I think is important.
Yeah, turning it into an ongoing conversation as opposed to the, you know, you tour and every other year you put out a record it's a very different structure. RJ mentioned playing some music and we exchanged some notes beforehand and you mentioned you wanted to highlight a great show, 12/31/93. So we'd like to send everybody out with some tracks from that. Do you want to tell us a little bit about why you picked that, besides obviously it's amazing?
Well, if you go back, and again, this is kind of what I was just talking about. There were no, without the internet, which in 93, I didn't have access to the internet. There was no real way to get tapes. I mean, it seems like a silly thing to say it. I'm sure there are Grateful Dead tapers out there that are old enough to, you know, that they knew the right people. But from my experience, when I first found these digital CDs, which I've later learned was a major, you know, ethical dilemma, that these import stores that would sell the, you know, for $50 you could buy it imported from Europe or whatever. Mm-hmm. But at the time I was just hungry for any live Fish that I could get my hands on, because I had, you know, I could buy the album, but that wasn't the thing about Fish that I fell in love with. Obviously it was the show. So there was one little store on Cape Cod where I grew up that, you know, some old hippie guy worked at, and when I found that store and I found that they had import CDs, before I knew that it was, you know, ethically wrong and that it was, you know, taking money away from the band potentially, this was one of the first like two or three that I got. And I wasn't actually at the show. It was again at a time while I was still in high school, and I just, way of knowing about it or getting there, but I just listened to it so many times over and over and over again. And so it's like every song in my head sounds like the definitive version. And in particular, the Reba is just one of my all-time favorites.
Stunning.
Yeah, it's one of those things where you think to yourself, you know, it sounds like somebody sat down and scripted that on, you know, like composition paper. And to think that they just walked out there and just did that off the cuff, you know, it's amazing to me, like just how every note is perfect.
Really is.
And also how young they sound and the energy in the room.
Yeah.
And I had this thought the other night when I was listening to it. I was like, you know, those are mostly all the same people that are still going today, but they were all 20 instead of 40, you know, and everyone right. was just like so energetic, the band included. You know, you can just hear that the roof is about to explode off the place. It's really incredible. Yeah.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned the CD. I had this CD too in 1994. And the first, I don't know when I got it, so probably in the middle of the year or so, you know, it had been a little while since the show, of course, but it was that year before I got to see them for my first time. And we listened to the ever loving crap out of this disc, just, well, these discs, I should say. We played it all the time.
And, yeah.
My friends, some of whom listen and who remember those days, they'll remember it vividly because just the Down with the Disease jam at the New Year's, you know, was mind blowing. And all of these songs, the Reba, the Antelope, the Melt, just so good.
Right. Little did the crowd know that that would become the jam that would be played almost every New Year's in the next, you know, 10 to 15 years. It didn't have a name yet, right? That was just just the riff.
It's an awesome show. Because it was on the radio, we get like, you know, we get the perfect sound, which doesn't hurt. I guess we could have gotten soundboards anyway, cause there were some floated around, right. Around that time, but it's interesting. I had the Santa Barbara, like the 41692 CD bootleg.
Oh, me too.
Had that too.
That's the one I always remember. It's kind of amazing.
And the bass was so loud in the mix.
Yeah. Right.
That was the thing that always blew me away about those recordings.
Well, so we're going to leave you with four awesome tracks, jams from that show, which we could talk about for another hour, but we won't because Jefferson has a life outside of talking to us.
What?
Jefferson, I guess I should have said this at the beginning, but we're really huge admirers of your work. And I think your lighting work is incredible. And, every time I go to an Umphrey show, I'm really impressed. So thank you for all you contribute.
Well, thank you. I didn't even realize you guys went to Umphrey shows. Next time you're there, come say hi, not during a song, but like before or after the show. I would love to meet you guys.
Yeah,
I just saw my first Umphreys at Lock-In this year, actually.
Oh, that was an amazing time.
Yeah, we had a good weekend.
Yeah, I hope to see them more. And I have a lot of good, really good friends who are also Fish fans who are, you know, pushing me to get outside of my comfort zone. I appreciate that, and I'll continue to do it. So seeing the lights is a huge part of it. So thanks for all the work, and thank you for taking the time to chat with us. We've taken up a lot of your time, and we really appreciate the chat.
Well, just as a quick aside, the last couple of weeks have obviously been really horrible, depending on, I assume most of your listeners agree with us politically, but this has been such a nice escape for me. I had to like stop paying attention to the news and like stop listening to regular radio and stop reading. And this is like a really great distraction. So you got me through a really hard time. So thank you.
Awesome. That's good to hear. Yeah.
That's very kind.
We're all doing what we can, you know, thanks everyone for listening. And, we'll be back again, in a week or two with another new episode. And you've been hearing us chat with, Jefferson Waffle, who's at Jefferson Waffle, WAFUL on Twitter. If you don't already follow him, you should. And, go check him out.
Good follow.
What's that?
I said he's a good follow.
He's a good follow. And and go check out his work. Check out Umphrey's, if you're not already planning to, which everyone probably is. So, cool. Well, thanks Jefferson. Thanks Jonathan. And, we'll talk to everyone next time.
Thanks, guys.
All
right, keep on rocking.
What is a city without its music?
The legacy of the New York Philharmonic
is incredible. Nearly two centuries of history. That's a lot of music and a lot of stories.
I was sitting on stage for the very first time thinking, I can't quite believe this is happening.
Join me, Jamie Bernstein, as we explore the history of the New York Philharmonic. It's the NY Phil Story Made in New York, a podcast about a city, its people, and their orchestra. Listen wherever you get podcasts. Oh.
paper rhythm is a razor just like us, a needle with a broom. Knee deep in the boy-tail tub, slip reel down the lip from a lip. Dip, sip, with a balance with a nag, with a lipstick perfume, butter to a farmer to try. Take a peek at the cheetah, with a cheetah on the prowl, and a cage, sink a boulder in the water, tie a cable to a tree. Put an inch to the nag, with a lipstick perfume, nibble flesh and flesh farm, left over thinner in a circle. Down the pipes. Bag it, tag it, sell it to the butcher in the store. Oh, bag it, tag it, sell it to the butcher in the store. Oh, bag it, tag it, sell it to the butcher in the store. Oh, bag it, tag it, sell it to the butcher in the store. The pool stopper at the bottom of the tub picked up the jar, unscrewed the top and washed it, drop into the water. A little scoop of plaster mixed some coffee grounds and mud, and then she stirred it with a ladle that her grandmother had bought her. Threw in a pot of melted wax, a 4 foot and a hoof, apple core, worms galore, a can of some corrosive, coconuts and chloroform, some wicker and some corn, a toxic waste of purple paint she hoped was not explosive. Ribbed up a ladle for a taste of her creation, and she knew that what she made would be the finest in the nation. Bag it, tag it, sell it to the butcher in the store. Oh, bag it, tag it, sell it to the butcher in the store. Oh, bag it, tag it, sell it to the butcher in the store. Oh, bag it, tag it. Bag it, tag it, sell it to the butcher in the store. Oh, bag it, tag it, sell it to the butcher in the store. Oh, bag it, tag it, sell it to the butcher in the store. Oh, bag it, tag it. Thank you.
bag it, tag it, sell it to the butcher in the store. Oh, bag it, tag it, sell it to the butcher in the store. Oh, bag it, tag it, sell it to the butcher in the store. Oh, bag it, tag it. Bag it, tag it, sell it to the butcher in the store. Oh, bag it, tag it, sell it to the butcher in the store. Oh, bag it, tag it, sell it to the butcher in the store. Oh, bag it, tag it. Tag it, sell it to the butcher in the store. Oh, bag it, tag it, sell it to the butcher in the store. Oh, bag it, tag it, sell it to the butcher in the store. Oh, bag it, tag it.
Thank you. We'll be right back. honor. Thank you, Mr. Miner. Thank you, Mr. Miner. Thank you, Mr. Miner. Thank you, Mr. Miner. Thank you, Mr. Thank you.
Hey everyone, it's Cam Hurt, host of the Best Show Ever podcast, and we have got a second season coming out very soon that I am very excited about. We've got some very cool special guests, including musical acts that we all love, like Karina Reichman, Daniel Donato, Jake Brownstein from Eggy, Rick and Peter from Goose, and many more. Tune in for new episodes dropping on Osiris Media March 5th on the Best Show Ever podcast.
Hey, what's up? My name's Lurk, and I'm the host of Lamb Goat's Van Flip podcast. Every week, I have in-depth conversations with bands from all over the scene, big and small. We also like to keep our finger on the pulse and showcase up-and-coming bands on the show as well. So come check out Lamb Goat's Van Flip podcast.